I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. There are votes, and then there are votes. Once upon a time, Canada was almost split in two. Over 93% of Quebecers showed up to vote in the 1995 referendum, and 49.42% of them voted for sovereignty. That tiny margin of difference, the slightest shift in the public conversation, and history would have taken a different path. Any number of factors might have made the difference, but here's one that obviously turned votes. Just months before the referendum, news broke that Jacques Parizeau, the premier of Quebec, was caught saying on the down low that once Quebecers voted for sovereignty, they would be trapped like lobsters thrown into boiling water. Not a great slogan for the separatist movement. That's what a story like that can do. That's what political journalism can do. It can change history. Now, the journalist who actually broke that story, she would argue with me about that. In fact, she did. Happy Lesser Canadian Thanksgiving, people. Today, we are pulling an episode from the vaults for your holiday listening pleasure. And this one, well, it's uncanny. My conversation with Chantal Hibert, recorded over 4 years ago when we were heading into the last federal election. Well, it is uncanny how much of it applies exactly to our situation today. Some of what you're about to hear has me nodding my head at how true it all still is. And some of it has me shaking my head in frustration. Chantal Hibert has a much more humble, utilitarian view of the role of journalists than I do. I admire her clear-eyed practicality, but when I hear her say, hey, it's not like Canada can make any difference on climate change anyhow, well, I still feel like the frustrated teenager at the Thanksgiving dinner table. Anyhow, here it is. Here she is, my fave of the pundit class, Toronto Star columnist and CBC political panelist, Chantal Hibert. Wait for it. This episode is brought to you by Aylin Williams, Patrick Plested, Heather Egger, David Lindenbach, Bernie Perusse, Jay Ree, Jillian Vrooman, and Jennifer Ricard.
I'm Jennifer, a librarian living in Montreal. I support Canada Land because as a librarian, I think it's important to think critically about the media we consume. I would support it even more if you talked more about Quebec.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter, like, seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get, like, anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding, like, the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. There are votes, and then there are votes. Once upon a time, Canada was almost split in two. Over 93% of Quebecers showed up to vote in the 1995 referendum, and 49.42% of them voted for sovereignty. That tiny margin of difference, the slightest shift in the public conversation, and history would have taken a different path. Any number of factors might have made the difference, but here's one that obviously turned votes. Just months before the referendum, news broke that Jacques Parizeau, the premier of Quebec, was caught saying on the down low that once Quebecers voted for sovereignty, they would be trapped like lobsters thrown into boiling water. Not a great slogan for the separatist movement. That's what a story like that can do. That's what political journalism can do. It can change history. Now, the journalist who actually broke that story, she would argue with me about that. In fact, she did. Happy Lesser Canadian Thanksgiving, people. Today, we are pulling an episode from the vaults for your holiday listening pleasure. And this one, well, it's uncanny. My conversation with Chantal Hibert, recorded over 4 years ago when we were heading into the last federal election. Well, it is uncanny how much of it applies exactly to our situation today. Some of what you're about to hear has me nodding my head at how true it all still is. And some of it has me shaking my head in frustration. Chantal Hibert has a much more humble, utilitarian view of the role of journalists than I do. I admire her clear-eyed practicality, but when I hear her say, hey, it's not like Canada can make any difference on climate change anyhow, well, I still feel like the frustrated teenager at the Thanksgiving dinner table. Anyhow, here it is. Here she is, my fave of the pundit class, Toronto Star columnist and CBC political panelist, Chantal Hibert. Wait for it. This episode is brought to you by Aylin Williams, Patrick Plested, Heather Egger, David Lindenbach, Bernie Perus, Jay Ree, Jillian Vrooman, And Jennifer Ricard.
I'm Jennifer, a librarian living in Montreal. I support Canada Land because as a librarian, I think it's important to think critically about the media we consume. I would support it even more if you talked more about Quebec.
So what is it exactly you want to talk about?
I don't know. This may be a terrible test of your patience.
No, you can't test my patience. I have time to kill. You may think I'm a busy person, but I am not.
You may be just too annoyed after this. I don't know.
Really get annoyed.
I can't promise you an informed discussion.
I'm not looking for an informed discussion.
I'm a very ignorant person when it comes to Canadian politics.
I'm a very ignorant person in general, so we should get along just fine.
I'm certainly ignorant for somebody who covers the Canadian media, but I may even be ignorant of Canadian politics as a Canadian citizen.
You probably know more than you think, voters.
I take no responsibility for my ignorance. I blame Canada's political press.
Okay. I blame, in part, voters.
Yeah.
And I say that as someone who spent 3 long years writing at the end of every story on the Meech Lake Accord. The Meech Lake Accord recognizes Quebec as a distinct society, gives it a veto over Senate reform, says that provinces have to submit names for the Supreme Court. Do you want me to go on?
Uh-huh.
The 5... And after 3 years, they'll lament, we don't know what's in the Meech Lake Accord. Right. And I figure, because I covered it in French, but that's when I started doing stuff in English.
Yeah.
Most Quebecers knew what was in the Meech Lake Accord, so I figured we don't know because we didn't care to know for a long, long time.
It's the Meech Lake Accord. You've already lost a lot of people right there.
Well, when they came out and said, we have found a way to fix the Constitution and have national reconciliation, a hell of a lot of people paid attention, right?
That's more interesting.
I remember Le Devoir's headline that said, it's hard to imagine today when you look at it, but the headline the next day was, Canada says yes to Quebec.
Yeah.
In my lifetime, I saw those headlines. Maybe if not as many people had ended up caring about the Meech Lake Accord, it would have passed. But it became a perception issue.
Yes.
And you're right on one point. And we're not talking about the Meech Lake Accord here. We're talking about ignorance. The people who made that accord, who were premiers and prime minister and leader of the opposition in the case of the federal ones, decided that because they had a deal, they didn't need to explain it.
Right.
And they left this vacant field to people who didn't like the deal and who could speak the language. Pierre Trudeau, I go down the list. By the time they woke up and discovered that since they decided they shouldn't make their case to people, others had made the case for them and it was now a lost cause. It was too late.
If only there was some institution in society whose job it was to engage people and inform them about what's going on.
Do you want to see the pile of stuff that people who cover politics wrote, talk to normal people, covered Pierre Trudeau, wrote lengthy explanation about every single section of that accord, tried in other ways to show that for Quebecers, yeah, Quebecers are different. Distinct does not mean superior, but you can't deny that there are differences. It's very hard for Quebecers to understand why other Canadians would not know that they're distinct and different. There are only so many ways you can say something until you come to the conclusion that in the end, the Canadian elite said yes to Quebec, but the Canadian people in the end said no.
I lived in Montreal for 10 years. I found out that they're distinct, different, and...
It sounds like a no-brainer. So if, you know, the answer is we don't think so, or we don't like that you are, was
yeah.
How it was heard. And in the end, the Meech Lake Accord wasn't a constitutional story. It was a story about how we talk past each other.
Yes.
And yes, the media has a responsibility for those failures, because for a long time... The story that's more exciting takes over from the story that's more constructive.
But are they not the same story? Like, I was clicking around trying to find a way into engaging with you today, and I had no idea that if not for the journalism you did during the referendum, it sounds to me like there's a good chance the margin was so small, you tell Quebecers that they are actually lobsters about to be boiled, and you could turn a bunch of people off of that referendum. you may have actually played a crucial role in keeping this country together. That's interesting.
Others would argue that I probably played a crucial role in shoring up sovereignty numbers with my coverage of the constitutional debate.
Uh-huh.
So at the end of the day, I don't think it works really well for journalists to feel so invested with social responsibility that they self-censor themselves in case they may have contributed to one outcome versus another. Because at that point, you're no longer doing whatever it is you do. That lobster story was the only real brown envelope. They don't exist anymore, I know, but I managed to get one real brown envelope in all of my life.
Yeah.
It landed in the mailbox of La Presse in July when I was alone. I opened it. It was a memo from one civil servant to another at Foreign Affairs. And it said Jacques Parizeau had told the EU ambassadors when he was asked, what if Quebecers vote yes in 3 months? And then they changed their minds. They decide they don't like it. And he went, ho, ho, ho. It's going to be too late. They're going to be like lobsters in a lobster pot. This is one of these ambassadors wants a favor from Canada to get a seat on some council somewhere.
Yeah.
And so I'm offering you this tidbit in exchange for you liking me, the civil servant types it. And I kind of looked at it and thought, do I really have to go through this? Like, I could see what was going to happen if I didn't take that envelope and put it in the trash can.
I've had that feeling where you just feel like, no one knows that I saw this.
Do I really want
what's
going to be happening for the next... And in the end, it was... I mean, in hindsight, it's always more fun than when you're in it and you're the person who wakes up with the paper on the doorstep. You see your byline and this... Les Québécois vont être comme des homards, and you think, this is going to be fun to cover, this referendum campaign.
I'll ask you for the translation.
Quebecers will be like lobsters.
Yeah.
And in the end, we got the story. The good thing about the story is instead of going with the story, we have a memo from Foreign Affairs. I asked around. I had good connections in those days to the... U.S. Embassy. They weren't there, but they had the best connections to anything. And they immediately confirmed that it had happened. But that wasn't a source. It wasn't on the record. What was great about the story is that in the end, we did have an ambassador on the record. And the only reason we got that is that Mr. Parizeau's office sent us that ambassador thinking he was going to deny the story.
Really?
And the Parizeau's office, after a day of screwing around with the, how do we handle this?
He had denied it. He sent you the diplomat.
Well, Parizeau's office eventually got wind of what was happening. I didn't call them. I called the Bloc Québécois. I figured they're going to call me. If I call the Bloc will call Jean-François Lisée, who was working then for Jacques Parizeau as a senior advisor, called me up. It was Friday afternoon and explained to me how I would not have a job as of Sunday if I went with the story. We went through the usual, I'm going to have your job while I'm sorry. And then he says, if I could provide you with people who were their ambassadors on the record denying that Mr. Parizeau said this, what would you do? Well, I said, I'd certainly, quote them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, it's Friday afternoon. It's very hard to find all these people. It's July. Would you give us till Monday? So I called my bosses and I made the case to them that this is the Premier of Quebec. We should probably give him the benefit of the doubt in the 3 days and do the story Tuesday. On Monday, nothing happens for hours. And finally, someone from the Belgium embassy calls. He's the Belgian ambassador. And he starts telling me, he said, Jean-François Lisée called me and he said, and he asked me to call you. And I have to say that I'm very sorry that Mr. Parizeau's confidence has been betrayed. And I go, excuse me, but you do realize you've just confirmed that Mr. Parizeau did say that. Oh, yes, he did say that, but he said it in confidence. I never figured out what game Belgium was playing. So
were they playing a game, or was this just...
I think they were playing a game. I suspect that Jean-François called the... and, you know, the ambassadors of the EU had various positions on federalism versus sovereignty. The French ambassador, for instance, I knew would not call me because I knew that he was a federalist sympathizer. I knew Great Britain would never call. Holland, because he had... He was the one who had told Foreign Affairs, couldn't call.
Yeah.
And so... I assumed afterwards when I thought about the story that the Belgium ambassador probably liked the no side better than the yes side, and so decided to confirm it all this time, protesting that it was so sad that Mr. Pegisot was betrayed. But the thing is, what I discovered months later when all this was done, says there were ambassadors who said, I didn't hear him say that.
Yeah.
It's because he said that to three of them as they were having cocktails before his speech.
I mean, this is just an incredible story.
It's, you know, it's one of those, I don't do this kind of journalism anymore.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy the chase.
Yeah.
And what you do once you're done. I did have a lot of fun doing that. That's that is a part of it that I do miss. And you can't be a columnist and do that, because the kind of columns you write, in the end, the temptation to shore up your own scoops would be too great. And in the end, it's also very hard. At La Presse, I did both. And one day I was asked, well, I'd write a Saturday column. I'd cover news. I was the bureau chief the rest of the week. So I'd written a column that had various sources in it that called for the very short-lived leader of the Bloc Québécois called Michel Gauthier to quit, that he was no Lucien Bouchard, he was his immediate successor. So I, you know, I put all that together and I explained what Gauthier's problem was. He couldn't speak English. There were a lot of reasons, and mostly he happened to be, sadly for him, the guy who came right after Bouchard. About a week later, Michel Gauthier quits. At that point, I'm wearing my bureau chief clothes of the reporter. I have to go stand in a scrum with, you know, a look on my face, a neutral look on my face, and say, why would you ever resign? So I missed the finding the story rather than doing the analysis.
The opining. I mean, you got to report a column as well sometimes, but...
Yes, but it's not the same.
No.
And, it's just not the same. There are loads of tricks you learn over the time that you actually cover news that you can't really use as a columnist, because it borders on the confusion. In French, we call it confusion des gens. You can't be party and that analyst at the same time. And if you're breaking news, you are party to a dynamics that is different.
I mean, there's all kinds of room for debate there about, if we're going to define a news reporter as some sort of impartial, objective robot.
I don't think so. But I think a news reporter is someone who is more on the lookout for breaking news than a columnist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Be it only because if you're going to find three topics a week, you're actually not spending a hell of a lot of time trying to think of stories to break, because you can't be doing everything.
Yeah. Well, you are in this world of punditry now and analysis. And so you just made the face.
I dislike the word pundit intensely.
So that's the face you just made. I'm going to show you, because this is actually an image that illustrates how I feel when I am watching a lot of punditry. And here we go.
Yes. I never see that. I'm not even looking. I've never seen myself on TV.
This is an animated GIF of you on the Ad Issue panel.
Yeah.
Responding to one of your fellow pundits.
The love thing.
That's it.
I know it's the love thing. I haven't seen it. I've heard about it.
This is an epic eye roll. This is just such an expression of exasperation.
I know.
And that's how I feel. In fact, only because I have you as my proxy can I watch this, because that's how I feel.
Yeah, well, don't show me, because I try to work on the face thing. Sometimes I can't help it.
Oh, it's wonderful.
And in that instance, I heard about it a lot. I was in Vancouver.
Yeah.
So I heard about it the next day. And I remember walking out of the hotel thinking, Oh, yeah, well, of course, you know, I just told the guy, what does love have to do with political analysis? And then I thought, maybe not love, but sex probably.
Yeah.
So, and then it got me thinking about all kinds of other dynamics that may explain why Eve Adams and Dimitri Soudas were so important to the liberals. But the thing with the at issue panel that's good, but that also makes these faces happen is you don't know what the others are going to say.
Yeah.
Since you don't know, sometimes you're not totally
sometimes
prepared.
Sometimes you make the accident of being very honest.
I'm not very good at the poker face thing, which is why I don't watch myself on TV, because I'd probably not go on TV.
How would you describe, though, the tenor of the conversation at this moment? Because I feel like there's an assumption being made that I am going to be very interested in politics as sport. And that I'm very interested, and like any sport, it gets to statistics and dramatics and interpersonal relationships. And it's not necessarily, I find that it's rare to encounter a discussion about politics as something that actually matters to people, that is consequential.
It's a mix of both. That's like saying that hockey is about statistics. It's also about feelings mixed in those statistics. There's a hell of a lot of passion in the statistics that hockey lovers come up with.
But you got to care about hockey to have those feelings. Do you need to care about political strategy to give a damn about what's happening in Canadian politics?
I think that a lot of people actually find politics more interesting when you explain to them what is behind the scenes. It's maybe the opposite of watching a movie where you're not terribly interesting in being in the editing room because it's going to go on forever. The reactions we get from the panel, of course, people in the chattering class like the panel. I mean, they're mostly political junkies, but many, many people who are not people who go to public policy forum dinners actually talk to us about the panel.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, they seem to think it's more interesting than being explained the intricacies of the equalization formula.
Right, which sounds equally...
or the budget.
Or worse.
I met a guy on the ferry today, and he said, so what are you going to talk about tonight? You were already on Tuesday. He seemed as excited by the budget as I was. And I said, well, we're going to probably talk about the Ontario budget, because we kind of did the federal one and killed it to death. And he said, you know, he says, I earned, and this guy wasn't one of the lawyers on the ferry. He says, I earn over $100,000, but my kids are in university. My wife doesn't work. I don't have $10,000 to put in a savings account at the end of any year.
Yeah.
I thought, well, you know, it seems that this argument that we kind of touched on really briefly, like who's an average person that's got this money left at the end of the year to
put
in? It did get true. I do stuff on Montreal radio and I meet, you know, people on the street and they talk to me about this. And I'm there four mornings a week. And when I started in September, I thought, they're going to get so sick of my voice.
Please don't confuse my critique as one that's directed towards specifically the at-issue panel at the National.
No. But
I find you interesting. And I find Andrew Coyne the same. But there is something that I'm trying to put my finger on when I watch Power and Politics, when I watch any of this at the radio. It assumes that I am in this world of strategists and pollsters. It assumes that the dynamics between the parties is of primary interest to me. I might be able to engage with that at a certain point, but as a way in, I'm concerned about where I fit into this.
I think you're not meant to fit in all of this. If you are watching Power and Politics, you're probably interested in this stuff. There are Parliament Hill shows. The first audience is the Parliament Hill bubble.
Yeah.
And it's not the only audience. But that is where the audience is. If you don't want all that, I, for one, don't really want to hear strategists and MPs give their talking points every single day. So I kind of take a pass and I'd rather, you know, listen to radio to a larger public affairs program than one that is focused on federal politics. Because at some point it's like, you know, always drinking the same thing every day for an hour. But because we have all news radio now, all news TV, you can have that and you can have other things. And you can choose not to watch all this and you can still be well informed about federal politics. So, but I don't think that because everyone is interested in the Power and Politics kind of stuff means that the people who are interested shouldn't have that show.
Sure, sure. Let there be many flowers bloom. If you're a wonk, there should be wonk shows. But I guess, can we not agree that there is a problem in a country with voter turnout as it is in Canada? Can we not agree that there's a problem along generational lines? We do not have the most enfranchised and engaged and active population.
I think part of the reason for that is that we are fortunate enough not to have huge problems. It's easier to be engaged when the government is thinking of joining a war in Iraq that George W. Bush is leading, or when you are having a huge national debate over the death penalty or the right to abortion, or even free trade with the United States, than when your biggest issue is whether it's okay to allow people to put 10,000 rather than 5,000 a year in the TSFA.
But that's not the biggest issue for most people. That's the issue for people who are engaged in the conversation.
Over the time that I've covered politics, the issues that consume national governments and public opinion were issues that national governments could actually advance, solve, or make worse. Mm-hmm. But today, the issues that people care about a lot, climate change, the trade-offs between privacy, security, international terrorism, even the global economy and what happens to your job when it gets taken away, they are all issues that don't get resolved on the national stage anymore. You can vote whoever you want tomorrow, Thomas Mulcair or Justin Trudeau or keep Stephen Harper. We will still be having the same debate, which will not be completely resolved by a national government. Ditto with climate change, no national government, especially of a smaller country, is going to resolve the climate change issue. We can work our way to a system that is more efficient where we do more. But I think it's kind of obvious that national governments now need to be thinking alongside other countries rather than national government and provinces. So these days, the prime minister spends more time meeting the president of France than he does meeting the premier of Ontario. That wouldn't have happened 20 years ago. Why does that happen? Because the prime minister actually needs to discuss stuff with the president of France that is more relevant to the issues than he would if he sat with the premier of Ontario.
But it's resolution may be a tall order. When we talk about the difference between having a bill like C-51, having a slightly different version of it that the Liberals might present, or not having it at all, that's a big difference that gets settled on the federal level. Whether or not you have a government that is completely in partnership with the oil patch or not is something that gets settled at the federal level.
Yes, and the majority of Canadians vote the way they vote, but which is against current government, but then they split their votes between two parties.
And then many of them don't vote at all.
Well, it's a right to not vote if you don't feel engaged. When Quebec had a referendum, 94% showed up to vote.
Yes, but
when we discussed free trade, more than 80%
sure.
turned out. So when you give people a choice, they do show up. But if they don't show up, it's because they don't think that there's enough of a choice to make it all worth their while to go vote.
Well, it has to do with what people think. And the magic word, again, is engagement. And then I say, whose job is that?
It's certainly not the job of the media to create engagement where issues and politicians don't.
Really?
I don't think so. I know. I don't buy the social mission. It's my job to report and give as much information as I can in context so that people can make reasoned decisions. But I cannot make the politicians more engaging. I cannot force them to actually talk to people.
You can make the issues more engaging.
No, I can't. I am not a priest. I don't go on in church on a Sunday to preach, this is what should be important to you and this is not. Even if I tried, I would get it wrong.
Let me ask you about this, because we're talking about what's appropriate for the media. And I think that we are really concerned, and there's a real Canadian sense of appropriateness and inappropriateness. So we have Trudeau for months and months and months really hanging back on nailing down any policies. Would it be appropriate for the press to demand that he say something? Alternately, would it be appropriate If Stephen Harper doesn't want to give a solid answer, a firm answer to the question, what did you know about that bribe and when, would it be appropriate for the press to ask him that at every opportunity until they get an answer? Or is that inappropriate for the media?
I don't think it's inappropriate, but I don't think it's particularly efficient. I watched Thomas Mulcair ask that latter question how many times in the House of Commons and get no answer. So, sure. So, after he doesn't answer 60 times, what do I do? I can't write a story about the non-answer, as everyone understands about the dynamics of what we do. I can't write a story every day that says the prime minister didn't answer today about what he knew. For the record, though, if Stephen Harper were here, he would say that he answered that he did not know. But that is the answer he gave, that he wasn't in on this deal, that he did not approve it, and that he certainly didn't order it.
I believe there are some fine-grain, incisive follow-ups that Andrew Coyne suggested that have yet to be
answered.
Yeah,
well, we can all suggest everything.
Yeah.
Right? I could suggest that someone somewhere is paying Pierre-Carl Péladeau to ruin the PQ by running for it.
But there were some inconsistencies in what Harper said and when he was...
Actually, the inconsistencies are on the part of Nigel Wright and the email where it says, I ran this by the prime minister.
Uh-huh.
We need Nigel Wright to say what he meant by this.
Uh-huh.
That will happen in court. But until it happens, we can't really hunt down Nigel Wright and put a knife to his throat and say, you're going to speak to us and you're going to do so today. On the Justin Trudeau thing, I would quarrel with your notion that he has come up with no policies.
I overstated that. And again, I'll point you back to my ignorance off the top.
No, but he has more of a policy on the way forward for the Senate than Stephen Harper has.
Yeah, my sense is that for reasons that because strategy is so often spoken of, that I'm aware that there was a strategy not being Harper and being who he is and saying as little as possible.
Possibly, but I think...
And despite that, and despite the fact that the NDP are actually the official opposition, the press seemed to abide that for a long period of time. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I understand that he has a policy on climate change that involves working with the provinces who have different plans. I understand that it's not sexy, but I would say that it's not realistic to have a different policy. I understand he's not into the carbon tax thing that Stéphane Dion was into. I understand that he has set aside the national child care program that is now NDP policy, but used to be Liberal policy. But I don't know what people think they're going to get when Justin Trudeau comes up with a policy, because he's not going to be coming up with some radical new way to run the Canadian economy from the federal government standpoint, nor is Mulcair for that purpose. So
I think I'm kind of discussing a possible shift in the climate of the conversation. You know, some time ago I had Susan Delacourt here and she argued quite passionately that she's never experienced, I hope I'm paraphrasing her correctly, such a docile time in the Ottawa press, that in every sense, from the level of access that the press has denied and has accepted.
I've always found the Ottawa press to be docile.
Always.
I find press galleries in general, not just in Ottawa. It's not a criticism of my colleagues as much as a finding about press galleries in general tend to see the government in power is the government in power forever. And if we're going to describe docility in the press gallery, can we just wind back the clock to Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin's era when no one had a single conservative Canadian Alliance name in his or her Rolodex because the Liberals were going to be there forever, were they not?
Right.
And the day that the Conservatives come, with Stephen Harper as prime minister, lo and behold, what has happened to all those great Liberal contacts? Usually your colleagues 6 months before who then switched over to the dark side and we're going to feed you stories forever because the Liberals, were they not going to be there forever? So if we're going to talk about a docile press gallery, can we somehow remember that it wasn't very assertive when the Liberals were in power? I don't remember those great challenging stories of you know, how the liberals are keeping from us. So when Jean Chrétien visits his riding, they were nicer.
There are two things we're trying to parse here. One is, 'twas ever thus? Is it any different now? And the second part is it as it should be? Now, I know that it has been argued on this show and elsewhere that we have never had a federal government that has been less open to the press, less available, less accessible, less forthcoming. And
I think it has hurt them.
Yeah.
As much as it has hurt the business of covering politics. And I think part of it has to do with the personality of the prime minister, his perception that the decks are stacked against conservatives, and that is shaped in part by the great movement between the press gallery and the liberal back offices that was par for the course. A lot of people went over to the dark side over the liberal years. Sometimes people who had just finished covering election campaigns where they'd covered Stephen Harper rather harshly. So his perception is not totally based on paranoia.
Right. I worked at the CBC. No one was trying to do him any favors there. But it is what it is, and it's something that became normalized, and the routines changed somewhat.
Yes, but you have to take Stephen Harper into the context of the social media era, too. Over this decade in particular, the rapidity at which information, misinformation circulates, the variety of places where it is has become so intense that governments, by and large, not just Stephen Harper's government, have not found a way to balance the need to communicate and the need that every government feels to control.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've retreated behind this wall. If you can't control what you communicate, you don't communicate. I'm not saying that it's the balance.
There's a global trend in communications throughout the world where why go through the filter of the press? You don't need to anymore. I understand what he's doing.
I don't buy the why go, not go. I think he needs the filter of the press because he's, in the end, I don't buy the notion. I know it's an exciting thesis, but I don't think at the end of the day that retail politics is the only way to win an election.
But dividing what he does, whether he's right about that or not, with his 24/7 channel and tweeting cabinet shuffles, whether that's a smart strategy or not.
Who cares if he's tweeting cabinet shuffles? What's the difference between that giving a press release?
It frees up press resources, perhaps.
But in the end, I don't really care. I was getting a press release from a press secretary.
That's right.
Now I'm getting a tweet.
Right. It makes our purpose much more clear.
I don't insult easily.
Yeah.
They're not my friends. They are not there to make my job easy.
Well, I don't think it's so much a question of the hurt feelings as much as with every step of removal and the guy doesn't do press conferences.
With every step of removal.
Shouldn't the press crying bloody murder or is that not appropriate?
I'm so old that in my young age, I got to watch some of those Friday news conferences that Pierre Trudeau used to give.
Yeah.
Sometimes I walk in a park on the way to buy a baguette in the morning just to make a caricature of my life, and there is a man that feeds pigeons.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of those news conferences. I mean, I have not seen any prime minister give regular news conferences that were not to his advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Including Brian Mulroney, who used to give more regular ones. I've not seen that. Where I would agree with Susan somewhere is that in the face of a government that really will do nothing for you, it would be nice if the press gallery became more aggressive in looking for stories rather than in against that government. Because it's more interesting to dig out stories. And if the press gallery dug out more disturbing stories, I'm not meaning scandals here, but more stories that don't make the government happy about having stories, the government would start keeping the press gallery busier.
Yeah.
And that is the dynamics. When I was a really young Parliament Hill person, I was invited, because I was the bureau chief of one, to one of those kind of mediated meetings between the civil service, the top civil service, and the parliamentary press gallery. And I sat there mute because here I'm sitting there. I could be in diapers. And they're all very senior people.
Okay. Right?
And one of the more senior journalists at the table, who was the bureau chief of a major bureau, told this deputy minister across the table. He says, you know, the way to control a journalist who is good at getting scoops out, the best way to control that journalist is to give him or her 3 scoops a month. And I listened to that, and I was a bit shocked to hear it. And then I thought about it, and it stayed with me. But that is quite true. If you make the government worried about what you may be up to, it's going to go out of its way to keep you busy.
Sure, but then they have enemies who are going to go out of their way to make you busy in a different direction, and then maybe you've got some autonomy where you're looking for your own stuff, but that's how it should be.
Yes.
Right?
But so, and that's why I'm not big on the, they're not, you know, they don't communicate with
no,
us.
No, I'm not with us. I'm not arguing the crybaby aspect.
If you
you're
want,
right. They're not on our side.
And if the press gallery has less resources, and newspapers seem to be happy with boring political stories rather than...
Well, that's an issue
more
right
edgy
there.
Ones.
Is it an issue as well, as Susan suggested, and as, well, a recent guest Mark Burry suggested, that we become too cozy and there's too many journalists who want to be senators or who are writing speeches?
No evidence that we are cozier than we were.
Where journalists rub elbows with elected officials? I mean...
I find nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying I haven't noticed it. And I'm not a big Ottawa person. I work out of Montreal. I visit my office not often, so I don't have a social life in Ottawa. It's not because I'm pure.
Yeah.
It's because that's not the life I have. I have kids and stuff and a real life.
You've been described as the consummate outsider and that you don't go to the pub after work.
Well, I don't drink beer. I had kids to raise. It's not a virtue. I was raising kids and I was a political journalist. What do parents do? As soon as they can, they go feed the kids who are now adults. And now I'm a grandmother, so I get to babysit instead. But the reason why I'm described as an outsider has nothing to do with the fact that I don't like beer.
But there is an inside, and it may be one where those worlds have overlapped.
Yeah, but when I started off in covering politics was at Queen's Park, and I was working for Radio Canada. Bill Davis was in power. The conservatives in Ontario did not have a lot of gains to make by giving or talking to Radio Canada.
Yeah.
Francophone is in Ontario tend to vote Liberal or NDP, and the Conservative Party was considered by the least friendly to the Francophone minority in those years, fairly or not. So I could see that, you know, there was some kind of back and fro between the power circles and some other journalist in the press gallery, and I certainly wasn't in the loop because why would you have me in the loop? But I also noticed that I didn't seem to know less than the people who were getting all this. So I came to this early, possibly misguided conclusion that anything like that was spin and that I wanted to live in a spin-free zone.
Yeah.
And that was that. So I never tried to have contacts. I never called someone to say, spin me, so I know what you're saying. I have the advantage of working in an office at the Star where others have to do stuff like that. So I have a vague sense of what people are actually saying. After a few years, you kind of know from what you hear what the spin probably was.
The closer you get, the further you might find yourself.
By the same token, I would say to anyone who wants to cover politics that if you don't like politicians, you shouldn't. Because if you can't understand them, you're not going to be able to cover them and understand what it is that makes them do what they do.
Well, while you're giving free advice, I could use some. Be a media critic. Well, I'll invite you to be a media critic with me, but I'm actually asking you for free pro bono consulting here because we're launching a politics show. We've got a couple of wonderfully intelligent guys hosting it. It's their show. I'm a consultant myself on this show. What, if anything, is missing from the scene? What's missing from our public conversation? Because I'm hearing a lot from you that there are good reasons for why things are the way they are, and yet I feel like things could be different and maybe should be.
It works best when people cut to the chase or are forced to cut to the chase. Allowing people to give their lines, it's not journalism, and it doesn't serve information to do it that way. Not just you, but many people dislike the strategist sitting together, the three. It's kind of a nightmare. It makes a caricature of politics. By the same token, elected politicians who agree to go on shows to mount the party line as if they leave their brains at the door, they demean their own jobs. At some point, if someone could show that, it would probably improve politics and its coverage. You know, we spent a long time on that issue, tearing up our shorts with a lot of virtue over how the political discourse had become debased and what was happening in question period was, you know, something you really didn't want to watch because it made you feel bad about politics and actually made you feel bad about what you did for a living having to cover that. And then one day someone, and it wasn't me, and I don't know who it was, had this notion that maybe instead we should show some of it. You know what? It's had a lot more impact than all those words we wasted. Mm-hmm. Because the politicians who demean themselves by acting like trained seals do not want to be looking at themselves. It's not news, right? They think they get away with it because we're not going to show it because in the end, there's nothing to show. But when you show that side of politics to viewers...
The parroting, the...
Yeah, all the you know, you the show pack. Them being stupid
yeah.
and insulting each other's intelligence.
Yeah.
They don't like that. They don't like their family to see that. They don't like their kids to say, that's why you're not there all week to do this.
Yeah.
And so I figure if you ever do a show on politics, you should show that stuff.
Yeah.
You should put a price on acting like that, giving a news conference to say nothing, refusing to answer questions, much better than asking every day for an answer, showing someone who repeatedly and editing it so that it drives the point. This is what you see. Much better than all those words we're using.
Here's
this
what
afternoon.
They said on Monday. Here they are saying it again on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Here's the next guy saying it
yeah.
on Wednesday.
Yeah.
They did it again.
We don't have enough time and we don't do enough of showing that.
Yeah.
And it works because a normal human person does not like to see himself or herself doing that stuff. So if I had a politics show, I would create a section of it just to show stuff like that. Because so it's not a picture, but it's worth a thousand words of punditry that is wasted.
Right.
Most people can tell when they see something that isn't right.
That's your Canada Land. I hope you liked it. If you did, rate it, review it, tell a friend about it. If you didn't like it, if you did like it, email me about it. I read everything that you send. We are on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is at CanadaLandShow.com. Check out a new episode of Oppo this week and also a new episode of Common's terrific series Dynasties this week, The Ford Family. Check it out. This episode is produced by our senior producer, Kasia Mihailovich, and by Jordan Cornish. The original episode was produced by me. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like this show, if you like our other shows, if you want ad-free versions of all of our podcasts, go to patreon.com/CanadaLand and become a Canada Land supporter. I hope you do.
So what is it exactly you want to talk about?
I don't know. This may be a terrible test of your patience.
No, you can't test my patience. I have time to kill. You may think I'm a busy person, but I am not.
You may be just too annoyed after this. I don't know.
Really get annoyed.
I can't promise you an informed discussion.
I'm not looking for an informed discussion.
I'm a very ignorant person when it comes to Canadian politics.
I'm a very ignorant person in general, so we should get along just fine.
I'm certainly ignorant for somebody who covers the Canadian media, but I may even be ignorant of Canadian politics as a Canadian citizen.
You probably know more than you think, voters.
I take no responsibility for my ignorance. I blame Canada's political press.
Okay. I blame, in part, voters.
Yeah.
And I say that as someone who spent 3 long years writing at the end of every story on the Meech Lake Accord. The Meech Lake Accord recognizes Quebec as a distinct society, gives it a veto over Senate reform, says that provinces have to submit names for the Supreme Court. Do you want me to go on?
Uh-huh.
The 5. And after 3 years, the lament, we don't know what's in the Meech Lake Accord. Right. And I figure because I covered it in French, but that's when I started doing stuff in English.
Yeah.
Most Quebecers knew what was in the Meech Lake Accord, so I figured we don't know because we didn't care to know for a long, long time.
It's the Meech Lake Accord You've already lost a lot of people right there.
Well, when they came out and said, we have found a way to fix the Constitution and have national reconciliation, a hell of a lot of people paid attention, right?
That's more interesting.
I remember Le Devoir's headline that said, it's hard to imagine today when you look at it, but the headline the next day was Canada says yes to Quebec.
Yeah.
In my lifetime, I saw those headlines. Maybe if not as many people had ended up caring about the Meech Lake Accord, it would have passed. But it became a perception issue.
Yes.
And you're right on one point, and we're not talking about the Meech Lake Accord here. We're talking about ignorance. The people who made that accord, who were premiers and prime minister and leader of the opposition in the case of the federal ones, decided that because they had a deal, they didn't need to explain it.
Right.
And they left this vacant field to people who didn't like the deal and who could speak the language. Pierre Trudeau, go down the list. By the time they woke up and discovered that since they decided they shouldn't make their case to people, others had made the case for them, and it was now a lost cause. It was too late.
If only there was some institution in society whose job it was to engage people and inform them about what's going on.
You want to see the pile of stuff that people who cover politics wrote, talked to normal people, covered Pierre Trudeau, wrote lengthy explanation about every single section of that accord, tried in other ways to show that for Quebecers, yeah, Quebecers are different. Distinct does not mean superior, but you can't deny that there are differences. It's very hard for Quebecers to understand why other Canadians would not know that they're distinct and different. There are only so many ways you can say something until you come to the conclusion that in the end, the Canadian elite said yes to Quebec, but the Canadian people in the end said no.
I lived in Montreal for 10 years. I found out that they're distinct, different, and...
It sounds like a no-brainer. So if, you know, the answer is we don't think so, or we don't like that you are, was how it was heard. And in the end, the Meech Lake Accord wasn't a constitutional story. It was a story about how we talk past each other.
Yes.
And yes, the media has a responsibility for those failures, because for a long time... The story that's more exciting takes over from the story that's more constructive.
But are they not the same story? Like, I was clicking around trying to find a way into engaging with you today, and I had no idea that if not for the journalism you did during the referendum, it sounds to me like there's a good chance the margin was so small, you tell Quebecers that they are actually lobsters about to be boiled, and you could turn a bunch of people off of that referendum. You may have actually played a crucial role in keeping this country together. That's interesting.
Others would argue that I probably played a crucial role in shoring up sovereignty numbers with my coverage of the constitutional debate.
Uh-huh.
So at the end of the day, I don't think it works really well for journalists to feel so invested with social responsibility that they self-censor themselves in case they may have contributed to one outcome versus another. Because at that point, you're no longer doing whatever it is you do. That lobster story was the only real brown envelope. They don't exist anymore, I know, but I managed to get one real brown envelope in all of my life.
Yeah.
It landed in the mailbox of La Presse in July when I was alone. I opened it. It was a memo from one civil servant to another at Foreign Affairs. And it said Jacques Parizeau had told the EU ambassadors when he was asked, what if Quebecers vote yes in 3 months? And then they changed their minds. They decide they don't like it. And he went, ho, ho, ho. It's going to be too late. They're going to be like lobsters in a lobster pot. This is one of these ambassadors wants a favor from Canada to get a seat on some council somewhere.
Yeah.
And so I'm offering you this tidbit in exchange for you liking me, the civil servant types it. And I kind of looked at it and thought, do I really have to go through this? Like, I could see what was going to happen if I didn't take that envelope and put it in the trash can.
I've had that feeling where you just feel like no one knows that I saw this.
Do I really want what's going to be happening for the next... And in the end, It was, I mean, in hindsight, it was, it's always more fun than when you're in it and you're the person who wakes up with the paper on the doorstep. You see your byline and this, les Québécois vont être comme des homards, and you think, this is going to be fun to cover, this referendum campaign.
I'll ask you for the translation.
Quebecers will be like lobsters.
Yeah.
And in the end, we got the story. The good thing about the story is instead of going with the story, just, you know, we have a memo from Foreign Affairs. I asked around. I had good connections in those days to the U.S. Embassy. They weren't there, but they had the best connections to anything. And they immediately confirmed that it had happened. But that wasn't a source. It wasn't on the record. What was great about the story is that in the end, we did have an ambassador on the record. And the only reason we got that is that Mr. Pegizot's office sent us that ambassador thinking he was going to deny the story.
Really?
And the Pegizot's office, after a day of screwing around with the, you know, how do we handle this?
He had denied it. He sent you
well,
the diplomat.
Well, Pegizot's office eventually got wind of what was happening.
Uh-huh.
I didn't call them. I called the Bloc Québécois. I figured they're going to call me. If I call the Bloc will call Jean-François Lisée, who was working then for Jacques Pégisot as a senior advisor, called me up. It was Friday afternoon and explained to me how I would not have a job as of Sunday if I went with the story. We went through the usual, I'm going to have your job, well, I'm sorry. And then he says, if I gave you, if I could provide you with people who were their ambassadors on the record denying that Mr. Pégisot said this, would you... What would you do? I said, well, I'd certainly, you know, quote them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, it's Friday afternoon. It's very hard to find all these people. It's July. Would you give us till Monday? So I called my bosses and I made the case to them that this is the Premier of Quebec. We should probably give him the benefit of the doubt in the 3 days and do the story Tuesday. On Monday, nothing happens for hours. And finally, someone from the Belgium embassy calls. He's the Belgian ambassador. And he starts telling me, he said, Jean-François Lisée called me and he said, and he asked me to call you. And I have to say that I'm very sorry that Mr. Pegizot's confidence has been betrayed. And I go, excuse me, but you do realize you've just confirmed that Mr. Pegizot did say that. Oh, yes, he did say that, but he said it in confidence. I never figured out what game Belgium was playing. So,
were they playing a game or was this just...
I think they were playing a game. I suspect that Jean-François called... and, you know, the ambassadors of the EU had various positions on federalism versus sovereignty. The French ambassador, for instance, I knew would not call me because I knew that he was a federalist sympathizer.
Uh-huh.
I knew Great Britain would never call. Holland, because he was the one who had told Foreign Affairs, couldn't call.
Yeah.
And so I assumed afterwards when I thought about the story that the Belgium ambassador probably liked the no side better than the yes side. And so decided to confirm it all this time, protesting that it was so sad that Mr. Pegizot was betrayed. But the thing is, what I discovered months later when all this was done, says there were ambassadors who said, I didn't hear him say that.
Yeah.
It's because he said that to three of them as they were having cocktails before his speech.
I mean, this is just an incredible story.
It's, you know, it's one of those, I don't do this kind of journalism anymore.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy the chase.
Yeah.
And what you do once you're done. I did have a lot of fun doing that. That's that is a part of it that I do miss. And you can't be a columnist and do that because the kind of columns you write, in the end, the temptation to shore up your own scoops would be too great. And in the end, it's also very hard. At La Presse, I did both. And one day I was asked, well, I'd write a Saturday column. I'd cover news. I was the bureau chief the rest of the week. So I'd written a column that had various sources in it that called for the very short-lived leader of the Bloc Québécois called Michel Gauthier to quit, that he was no Lucien Bouchard. He was his immediate successor. So I, you know, I put all that together and I explained what Gauthier's problem was. He couldn't speak English. there were a lot of reasons, and mostly he happened to be, sadly for him, the guy who came right after Bouchard. About a week later, Michel Gauthier quits. At that point, I'm wearing my bureau chief clothes of the reporter. I have to go stand in a scrum with, you know, a look on my face, a neutral look on my face, and say, why would you ever resign? So I missed the finding the story rather than doing the analysis.
The opining. I mean, you got to report a column as well sometimes, but...
Yes, but it's not the same.
No.
And, it's just not the same. There are loads of tricks you learn over the time that you actually cover news that you can't really use as a columnist because it borders on a confusion. In French, we call it confusion des gens. You can't be party and an analyst at the same time. And if you're breaking news, you are party to a dynamics that is different.
I mean, there's all kinds of room for debate there about, if we're going to define a news reporter as some sort of impartial, objective robot.
I don't think so. But I think a news reporter is someone who is more on the lookout for breaking news than a columnist.
Yeah, yeah.
Be it only because if you're going to find three topics a week, you're actually not spending a hell of a lot of time trying to think of stories to break because you can't be doing everything.
Yeah. Well, you are in this world of punditry now and analysis. And so you just made the face.
I dislike the word pundit intensely.
So that's the face you just made. I'm going to show you because this is actually an image that illustrates how I feel when I am watching a lot of punditry. And here we go.
Yes. I never see that. I'm not even looking. I've never seen myself on TV.
This is an animated GIF of you on the At Issue panel.
Yeah.
Responding to one of your fellow pundits.
The love thing.
That's it.
I know it's the love thing. I haven't seen it. I've heard about it.
This is an epic eye roll. This is just such an expression of exasperation.
I know.
And that's how I feel. Only because I have you as my proxy can I watch this, because that's how I feel.
Yeah, well, don't show me, because I try to work on the face thing. Sometimes I can't help it.
Oh, it's wonderful.
And in that instance, I heard about it a lot. I was in Vancouver.
Yeah.
So I heard about it the next day. And I remember walking out of the hotel thinking, oh, yeah, well, of course, you know, I just told the guy, what does love have to do with political analysis? And then I thought, maybe not love, but sex probably.
Yeah.
So, and then it got me thinking about all kinds of other dynamics that may explain why Eve Adams and Dimitri Soudas were so important to the liberals. But the thing with the At Issue panel that's good, but that also makes these faces happen, is you don't know what the others are going to say.
Yeah.
Since you don't know, sometimes you're not totally prepared.
You make the accident of being very honest.
I'm not very good at the poker face thing, which is why I don't watch myself on TV, because I'd probably not go on TV.
How would you describe, though, the tenor of the conversation at this moment? Because I feel like there's an assumption being made that I am going to be very interested in politics as sport, and that I'm very interested. And like any sport, it gets to statistics and dramatics and interpersonal relationships. And it's not necessarily, I find that it's rare to encounter a discussion about politics as something that actually matters to people, that is consequential.
It's a mix of both. That's like saying that hockey is about statistics. It's also about feelings mixed in those statistics. There's a hell of a lot of passion in the statistics that hockey lovers come up with.
But you got to care about hockey to have those feelings. Do you need to care about political strategy to give a damn about what's happening in Canadian politics?
I think that a lot of people actually find politics more interesting when you explain to them what is behind the scenes. It's maybe the opposite of watching a movie where you're not terribly interesting in being in the editing room because it's going to go on forever. The reactions we get from the panel, of course, people in the chattering class like the panel. I mean, they're mostly political junkies. But many, many people who are not people who go to public policy forum dinners actually talk to us about the panel.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, they seem to think it's more interesting than being explained the intricacies of the equalization formula.
Right. Which sounds equally...
Or the budget.
Or worse.
I met a guy on the ferry today, and he said, so what are you going to talk about tonight? You were already on Tuesday. He seemed as excited by the budget as I was. And I said, well, we're going to probably talk about the Ontario budget, because we kind of did the federal one and killed it to death. And he said, you know, he says, I earned... And this guy wasn't one of the lawyers on the ferry. He says, I earn over $100,000, but my kids are in university. My wife doesn't work. I don't have $10,000 to put in a savings account at the end of any year.
Yeah.
I thought, well, you know, it seems that this argument that we kind of touched on really briefly, like, who's an average person that's got this money left at the end of the year to
put
in? It did get through. I do stuff on Montreal radio, and I meet, you know, people on the street. They talk to me about this, and I'm there four mornings a week. And when I started in September, I thought, they're going to get so sick of my voice.
Please don't confuse my critique as one that's directed towards specifically the Ad Issue panel at the National.
No. But
I find you interesting and I find Andrew Coyne the same. But there is something that I'm trying to put my finger on. When I watch Power and Politics, when I watch any of this at the radio, it assumes that I am in this world of strategists and pollsters. It assumes that the dynamics between the parties is of primary interest to me. I might be able to engage with that at a certain point, but as a way in, I'm concerned about where I fit into this.
I think you're not meant to fit in all of this. If you are watching Power and Politics, you're probably interested in this stuff. There are Parliament Hill shows. The first audience is the Parliament Hill bubble.
Yeah.
It's not the only audience. But that is where the audience is. If you don't want all that, I, for one, don't really want to hear strategists and MPs give their talking points every single day. So I kind of take a pass, and I'd rather, you know, listen to radio to a larger public affairs program than one that is focused on federal politics. Because at some point, it's like, you know, always drinking the same thing every day for an hour. But because we have all news radio now, all news TV, you can have that and you can have other things. And you can choose not to watch all this and you can still be well informed about federal politics. So, but I don't think that because everyone is interested in the Power and Politics kind of stuff means that the people who are interested shouldn't have that show.
Sure. Sure, I mean, let there be many flowers bloom. If you're a wonk, there should be wonk shows. But I guess, can we not agree that there is a problem in a country with voter turnout as it is in Canada? Can we not agree that there's a problem along generational lines? We do not have the most enfranchised and engaged and active population.
I think part of the reason for that is that we are fortunate enough not to have huge problems. It's easier to be engaged when the government is thinking of joining a war in Iraq that George W. Bush is leading, or when you are having a huge national debate over the death penalty or the right to abortion, or even free trade with the United States, than when your biggest issue is whether it's okay to allow people to put 10,000 rather than 5,000 a year in the TSFA.
But that's not the biggest issue for most people. That's the issue for people who are engaged in the conversation.
Over the time that I've covered politics, the issues that consume national governments and public opinion were issues that national governments could actually advance, solve, or make worse.
Mm-hmm.
But today, the issues that people care about a lot, climate change, the trade-offs between privacy, security, international terrorism, even the global economy and what happens to your job when it gets taken away, they are all issues that don't get resolved on the national stage anymore. You can vote whoever you want tomorrow, Thomas Mulcair or Justin Trudeau or keep Stephen Harper. We will still be having the same debate, which will not be completely resolved by a national government. Ditto with climate change, no national government, especially of a smaller country, is going to resolve the climate change issue. We can work our way to a system that is more efficient where we do more. But I think it's, you know, kind of obvious that national governments now need to be thinking alongside other countries rather than national government and provinces. So these days, the prime minister spends more time meeting the president of France than he does meeting the premier of Ontario. That wouldn't have happened 20 years ago. Why does that happen? Because the prime minister actually needs to discuss stuff with the president of France that is more relevant to the issues than he would if he sat with the premier of Ontario.
But it's resolution may be a tall order. When we talk about the difference between having a bill like C-51, having a slightly different version of it that the Liberals might present, or not having it at all, that's a big difference that gets settled on the federal level. Whether or not you have a government that is completely in partnership with the oil patch or not is something that gets settled at the federal
level. Yes, and the majority of Canadians vote the way they vote, but which is against current government, but then they split their votes between two parties.
And then many of them don't vote at all.
Well, it's a right to not vote if you don't feel engaged. When Quebec had a referendum, 94% showed up to vote.
Yes, but
when we discussed free trade, more than 80%
sure.
turned out. So when you give people a choice, they do show up. But if they don't show up, it's because they don't think that there's enough of a choice to make it all worth their while to go vote.
Well, it has to do with what people think. And the magic word, again, is engagement. And then I say, whose job is that?
It's certainly not the job of the media to create engagement where issues and politicians don't.
Really?
I don't think so. I know. I don't buy the social mission. It's my job to report and give as much information as I can in context so that people can make reasoned decisions. But I cannot make the politicians more engaging. I cannot force them to actually talk to people.
You can make the issues more engaging.
No, I can't. No, I can't. I am not a priest. I don't go on in church on a Sunday to preach, this is what should be important to you and this is not. Even if I tried, I would get it wrong.
Let me ask you about this, because we're talking about what's appropriate for the media. And I think that we are really concerned, and there's a real Canadian sense of appropriateness and inappropriateness. So we have Trudeau for months and months and months really hanging back on nailing down any policies. Would it be appropriate for the press to demand that he say something? Alternately, would it be appropriate if Stephen Harper doesn't want to give a solid answer, a firm answer to the question, what did you know about that bribe and when, would it be appropriate for the press to ask him that at every opportunity until they get an answer? Or is that inappropriate for the media?
I don't think it's inappropriate, but I don't think it's particularly efficient. I watched Thomas Mulcair ask that latter question how many times in the House of Commons and get no answer. So, yeah, sure. So, after he doesn't answer 60 times, what do I do? I can't write a story about the non-answer, as everyone understands about the dynamics of what we do. I can't write a story every day that says the prime minister didn't answer today about what he knew. For the record, though, if Stephen Harper were here, he would say that he answered that he did not know. But that is the answer he gave, that he wasn't in on this deal, that he did not approve it, and that he certainly didn't order it.
I believe there are some fine-grain, incisive follow-ups that Andrew Coyne suggested that have yet to be
Yeah, well,
answered.
We can all suggest everything.
Yeah.
Right? I could suggest that someone somewhere is paying Pierre-Carl Péladeau to ruin the PQ by running for it.
But there were some inconsistencies in what Harper said and when he was...
Actually, the inconsistencies are on the part of Nigel Wright and the email where it says, I ran this by the prime minister.
Uh-huh.
We need Nigel Wright to say what he meant by this.
Uh-huh.
That will happen in court. But until it happens, we can't really hunt down Nigel Wright and put a knife to his throat and say, you're going to speak to us and you're going to do so today. On the Justin Trudeau thing, I would quarrel with your notion that he has come up with no policies.
I overstated that, and again, I'll point you back to my admission of ignorance off the top.
No, but he has more of a policy on the way forward for the Senate than Stephen Harper has.
Yeah, my sense is that for reasons that because strategy is so often spoken of, that I'm aware that there was a strategy in just not being Harper and being who he is and saying as little as possible.
Possibly, but I think...
And despite that, and despite the fact that the NDP are actually the official opposition, the press seemed to abide that for a long period of time. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I understand that he has a policy on climate change that involves working with the provinces who have different plans. I understand that it's not sexy, but I would say that it's not realistic to have a different policy. I understand he's not into the carbon tax thing that Stéphane Dion was into. I understand that he has set aside the national child care program that is now NDP policy, but used to be Liberal policy. But I don't know what people think they're going to get when Justin Trudeau comes up with a policy, because he's not going to be coming up with some radical new way to run the Canadian economy from the federal government standpoint, nor is Mulcair for that purpose. So
I think I'm kind of discussing a possible shift in the climate of the conversation. You know, some time ago I had Susan Delacourt here She you know, argued quite passionately that she's never experienced, I hope I'm paraphrasing her correctly, such a docile time in the Ottawa press, that in every sense, from the level of access that the press has denied and has accepted.
I've always found the Ottawa press to be docile.
Always.
I find press galleries in general, not just in Ottawa, it's not a criticism of my colleagues as much as a finding about press galleries in general, tend to see the government in power is the government in power forever. And if we're going to describe docility in the press gallery, can we just wind back the clock to Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin's era, when no one had a single conservative Canadian Alliance name in his or her Rolodex, because the Liberals were going to be there forever, were they not?
Right.
And the day that the Conservatives come, with Stephen Harper as prime minister, lo and behold, what has happened to all those great Liberal contacts? Usually your colleagues 6 months before, who then switched over to the dark side, and we're going to feed you stories forever, because the Liberals, were they not going to be there forever? So if we're going to talk about a docile press gallery, can we somehow remember that it wasn't very assertive when the Liberals were in power? I don't remember those great challenging stories of, you know, how the Liberals are keeping from us. So when Jean Chrétien visits his riding, they were nicer.
There are two things we're trying to parse here. One is, 'twas ever thus. Is it any different now? And the second part is it as it should be? Now, I know that it has been argued on this show and elsewhere that we have never had a federal government that has been less open to the press, less available, less accessible, less forthcoming. And
I think it has hurt them as much as it has hurt the business of covering politics. But I think part of it has to do with the personality of the prime minister, his perception that the decks are stacked against conservatives, and that is shaped in part by the great movement between the press gallery and the Liberal back offices that was par for the course. A lot of people went over to the dark side over the Liberal years. Sometimes people who had just finished covering election campaigns, where they'd covered Stephen Harper rather harshly. So his perception is not totally based on paranoia.
I worked at the CBC. No one was trying to do him any favors there. But it is what it is, and it's something that became normalized, and the routines changed somewhat.
Yes, you have to take Stephen Harper into the context of the social media era, too. Over this decade in particular, the rapidity at which information, misinformation circulates, the variety of places where it is, has become so intense that governments, by and large, not just Stephen Harper's government, have not found a way to balance the need to communicate and the need that every government feels to control.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've retreated behind this wall. If you can't control what you communicate, you don't communicate. I'm not saying that it's the balance.
Well, there's a global trend in communications throughout the world where why go through the filter of the press? You don't need to anymore. I understand what he's doing.
I don't buy the why go, not go. I think he needs the filter of the press because he's in the end, I don't buy the notion. I know it's an exciting thesis, but I don't think at the end of the day that retail politics is the only way to win an election.
But dividing what he does, whether he's right about that or not, with his 24/7 channel and tweeting cabinet shuffles, whether that's a smart strategy or
who
not.
Who cares if he's tweeting cabinet shuffles? What's the difference between that giving a press release?
It frees up press resources, perhaps.
But in the end, I don't really care. I was getting a press release from a press secretary.
That's right.
Now I'm getting a tweet.
Right. I think it makes our purpose much more clear.
I don't insult easily.
Yeah.
They're not my friends. They are not there to make my job easy.
Well, I don't think it's so much a question of the hurt feelings as much as with every step of removal. And as, you know, I mean, the guy doesn't do press conferences.
With every step of removal.
Shouldn't the press crying bloody murder, is that not appropriate?
I'm so old that in my young age, I got to watch some of those Friday news conferences that Pierre Trudeau used to give.
Yeah.
Sometimes I walk in a park on the way to buy a baguette in the morning just to make a caricature of my life. And there is a man that feeds pigeons.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of those news conferences. I mean, I have not seen any prime minister give regular news conferences that were not to his advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Including Brian Mulroney, who used to give more regular ones. I've not seen that. Where I would agree with Susan somewhere is that in the face of a government that really will do nothing for you, it would be nice if the press gallery became more aggressive in looking for stories rather than in against that government, because it's more interesting to dig out stories. And if the press gallery dug out more disturbing stories, I'm not meaning scandals here, but more stories that don't make the government happy about having stories, the government would start keeping the press gallery busier.
Yeah.
And that is the dynamics. When I was a really young Parliament Hill person, I was invited, because I was the bureau chief of one, to one of those kind of mediated meetings between the civil service, the top civil service, and the parliamentary press gallery. And I sat there mute because here I'm sitting there. I could be in diapers. And they're all very senior people.
Okay. Right?
And one of the more senior journalists at the table, who was the bureau chief of a major bureau, told this deputy minister across the table, he says, you know the way to control a journalist who is good at getting scoops out. The best way to control that journalist is to give him or her 3 scoops a month. And I listened to that, and I was a bit shocked to hear it. And then I thought about it, and it stayed with me. But that is quite true. If you make the government worried about what you may be up to, it's going to go out of its way to keep you busy.
Sure, but then they have enemies who are going to go out of their way to make you busy in a different direction, and then maybe you've got some autonomy where you're looking for your own stuff, but that's how it should be.
Yes.
Right?
And that's why I'm not big on the, they're not, you know, they don't communicate with
us.
No,
I'm not with us. I'm not arguing the crybaby aspect. Right, they're not on our side.
And if the press gallery has less resources, and newspapers seem to be happy with boring political stories rather than...
Well, that's an issue right there.
Ones.
Is it an issue as well, as Susan suggested, and as, well, a recent guest, Mark Burry, suggested, that we become too cozy and there's too many journalists who want to be senators or who are writing speeches?
No evidence that we are cozier than we were.
Where journalists rub elbows with elected officials? I mean...
I find nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying I haven't noticed that. And I'm not a big Ottawa person. I work out of Montreal. I visit my office not often, so I don't have a social life in Ottawa. It's not because I'm pure.
Yeah.
It's because that's not the life I have. I have kids and stuff and a real life.
You've been described as the consummate outsider and that you don't go to the pub after work.
Well, I don't drink beer. I had kids to raise. It's not a virtue. I was raising kids and I was a political journalist. What do parents do? As soon as they can, they go feed the kids who are now adults. And now I'm a grandmother, so I get to babysit instead. But the reason why I'm described as an outsider has nothing to do with the fact that I don't like beer.
But there is an inside, and it may be one where those worlds have overlapped.
Yeah, but when I started off in covering politics, was at Queen's Park, and I was working for Radio-Canada. Bill Davis was in power. The conservatives in Ontario did not have a lot of gains to make by giving or talking to Radio Canada.
Yeah.
Francophones in Ontario tend to vote Liberal or NDP, and the Conservative Party was considered by the least friendly to the Francophone minority in those years, fairly or not. So I could see that, you know, there was some kind of back and fro between the power circles and some other journalist in the press gallery, and I certainly wasn't in the loop because why would you have me in the loop? But I also noticed that I didn't seem to know less than the people who were getting all this. So I came to this early, possibly misguided conclusion that anything like that was spin and that I wanted to live in a spin-free zone.
Yeah.
And that was that. So I never tried to have contacts. I never called someone to say, spin me. So I know what you're saying. I have the advantage of working in an office at the Star where others have to do stuff like that. So I have a vague sense of what people are actually saying. After a few years, you kind of know from what you hear what the spin probably was.
The closer you get, the further you might find yourself.
By the same token, I would say to anyone who wants to cover politics that if you don't like politicians, you shouldn't. Because if you can't understand them, you're not going to be able to cover them and understand what it is that makes them do what they do.
Well, while you're giving free advice, I could use some. Be a media critic. Well, I'll invite you to be a media critic with me, but I'm actually asking you for free pro bono consulting here because we're launching a politics show. We got a couple of wonderfully intelligent guys hosting it. It's their show. I'm a consultant myself on this show. What, if anything, is missing from the scene? What's missing from our public conversation? Because I'm hearing a lot from you that there are good reasons for why things are the way they are, and yet I feel like things could be different and maybe should be.
It works best when people cut to the chase or are forced to cut to the chase. Allowing people to give their lines, it's not journalism, and it doesn't serve information to do it that way. Not just you, but many people dislike the strategist sitting together, the three. It's kind of a nightmare. It makes a caricature of politics. By the same token, elected politicians who agree to go on shows to mount the party line as if they leave their brains at the door, they demean their own jobs. At some point, if someone could show that, it would probably improve politics and its coverage. You know, we spent a long time on that issue, tearing up our shorts with a lot of virtue over how the political discourse had become debased and what was happening in question period was, you know, something you really didn't want to watch because it made you feel bad about politics and actually made you feel bad about what you did for a living having to cover that. And then one day someone, and it wasn't me, and I don't know who it was, had this notion that maybe instead we should show some of it. You know what? It's had a lot more impact than all those words we wasted. Mm-hmm. Because the politicians who demean themselves by acting like trained seals do not want to be looking at themselves. It's not news, right? They think they get away with it because we're not going to show it because in the end, there's nothing to show. But when you show that side of politics to viewers...
The parroting, the...
Yeah, all the you know, you the show pack. Them being stupid
yeah.
and insulting each other's intelligence.
Yeah.
They don't like that. They don't like their family to see that. They don't like their kids to say, that's why you're not there all week to do this.
Yeah.
And so I figure if you ever do a show on politics, you should show that stuff.
Yeah.
You should put a price on acting like that. Giving a news conference to say nothing, refusing to answer questions, much better than asking every day for an answer, showing someone who repeatedly and editing it so that it drives the point. This is what you see. Much better than all those words we're using.
Here's
this
what
afternoon.
They said on Monday. Here they are saying it again on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Here's the next guy saying it
yeah.
on Wednesday.
Yeah.
They did it again.
We don't have enough time and we don't do enough of showing that.
Yeah.
And it works because a normal human person does not like to see himself or herself doing that stuff. So if I had a politics show, I would create a section of it just to show stuff like that. Because so it's not a picture, but it's worth 1,000 words of punditry that is wasted.
Right.
Most people can tell when they see something that isn't right.
That's your Canada Land. I hope you liked it. If you did,
rate it, review it, tell a friend about it. If you didn't like it, if you did like it, email me about it. I read everything that you send. We are on Twitter at CanadaLand. Our website is at CanadaLandShow.com. Check out a new episode of Oppo this week and also a new episode of Common's terrific series Dynasties this week, The Ford Family. Check it out. This episode is produced by our senior producer, Kasia Mihailovic, and by Jordan Cornish. The original episode was produced by me. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like this show, if you like our other shows, if you want ad-free versions of all of our podcasts, go to patreon.com/CanadaLand and become a Canada Land supporter. I hope you do.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.